Chapter 87. The Trial. At 8 o'clock in the morning, Albert had arrived at Beauchamp's door. The valet de chambre had received orders to introduce him into his master's room, who was just then bathing.
"Here I am," said Albert.
"Well, my poor friend," replied Beauchamp, "I expected you."
"I need not say I think you too faithful and too kind to have spoken of that painful circumstance. Your having sent for me is another proof of your affection. So, without losing time, tell me, have you the slightest idea whence this terrible blow proceeds?"
"I think I have some clue."
"But first tell me all the particulars of this shameful plot."
Beauchamp proceeded to relate to the young man, overwhelmed with shame and grief, the following facts. 2 days previously, the article had appeared in another paper besides the Impartial, and what was more serious, one that was well known as a government paper. Beauchamp was breakfasting when he read the passage. He sent immediately for a cabriolet and hastened to the publisher's office. Although professing diametrically opposite principles from those of the editor of the accusing paper, Beauchamp, as it sometimes, we may say often, happens, was his intimate friend. Beauchamp declared himself interested in the article referring to Morcerf.
"I think you are running a great risk of a prosecution for defamation of character," he said.
"Not at all. We have received with the information all the requisite proofs, and we are quite sure Monsieur de Morcerf will not raise his voice against us. Besides, it is rendering a service to one's country to denounce those wretched criminals who are unworthy of the honour it bestows on them."
Beauchamp remained thunderstruck.
"Who, then, has so correctly informed you?" asked he. "For my paper, which had announced the subject, has been obliged to stop for want of proof. And yet we are more interested than you in exposing Monsieur de Morcerf, as he is a peer of France, and we are of the opposition."
"Oh, that is very simple. We have not sought to scandalize. This news was brought to us. A man arrived yesterday from Janina, bringing the formidable bundle, and as we hesitated to publish the accusatory article, he told us it should be inserted in some other paper."
Beauchamp understood that nothing remained but to submit, and left the office to dispatch a courier to Morcerf. But he had been unable to send to Albert the following particulars, as the events had transpired after the messenger's departure. Namely, that the same day a great agitation was manifest in the House of Peers among the usually calm groups of the noble assembly. Everyone had arrived almost before the usual hour, and was conversing on the melancholy event which was to attract the attention of the public towards one of their most illustrious members. Some were perusing the article, others making comments, and recalling circumstances which substantiated the charges still more. The Count was no favourite with his colleagues. Like all upstarts, he had had recourse to a great deal of haughtiness to maintain his position. The true nobility laughed at him, the talented repelled him, and the honourable instinctively despised him. Such were the extremities to which the Count was driven. The finger of God once pointed at him, every one was prepared to raise the hue and cry after him. The Comte de Morcerf alone was ignorant of the news. He did not take in the paper containing the defamatory article, and had passed the morning in writing letters and in trying a horse. He arrived at his usual hour with a proud look and insolent demeanour. He alighted, passed through the corridors, and entered the house without observing the hesitation of the doorkeepers or the coolness of his colleagues. Business had already commenced half an hour when he entered. Everyone held the accusing paper, but, as usual, no one liked to take upon himself the responsibility of the attack. At length an honourable peer, Morcerf's acknowledged enemy, ascended the tribune with that solemnity which announced the expected moment had arrived. There was an imposing silence. Morcerf alone knew not why such profound attention was given to an orator who was not always listened to with so much complacency. The Count did not notice the introduction, in which the speaker announced that his communication would be of that vital importance that it demanded the undivided attention of the House. But at the names Janina and Colonel Fernand, he turned so awfully pale that every member shuddered and fixed his eyes upon him. The article having been read during this painful silence, a universal shudder pervaded the assembly, and immediately the closest attention was restored when the orator resumed. He stated his scruples and the difficulties of the case. It was the honour of Monsieur de Morcerf and that of the whole House he proposed to defend by provoking a debate on those personal questions always so warmly agitated. He concluded by calling for an examination which might confound the calumnious report before it had time to spread,
and restore Monsieur de Morcerf to the position he had long held in public opinion. Morcerf was so completely overwhelmed by this enormous and unexpected calamity that he could scarcely stammer a few words as he looked round on the assembly. This timidity, which might proceed from the astonishment of innocence as well as the shame of guilt, conciliated some in his favour, for men who are truly generous are always ready to compassionate when the misfortune of their enemy surpasses the limits of their hatred. The President put it to the vote, and it was decided the examination should take place. The Count was asked what time he required to prepare his defence. Morcerf's courage had revived when he found himself alive after this horrible blow.
"My lords," answered he, "it is not by time I could repel the attack made on me by enemies unknown to me, and doubtless hidden in obscurity. It is immediately, and by a thunderbolt, I must repel the flash of lightning which, for a moment, startled me. Oh, that I could, instead of taking up this defence, shed my last drop of blood to prove to my noble colleagues that I am their equal in worth."
These words made a favourable impression on behalf of the accused.
"I demand, then, that the examination should take place as soon as possible, and I will furnish the House with all necessary information."
"What day do you fix?" asked the President.
"Today I am at your service," replied the Count.
The President rang the bell.
"Does the House approve that the examination should take place today?"
"Yes,"
was the unanimous answer. A committee of 12 members was chosen to examine the proofs brought forward by Morcerf. The examination would commence at 8 o'clock that evening in the committee room, and if it were necessary to postpone it, it would be resumed each evening at the same hour. Morcerf asked leave to retire. He had to collect the documents he had long been preparing against this storm, which his sagacity had foreseen. Albert listened, trembling now with hope, then with anger, and then again with shame. For, from Beauchamp's confidence, he knew his father was guilty, and he asked himself how, since he was guilty, he could prove his innocence. Beauchamp hesitated to continue his narrative.
"What next?"
asked Albert.
"What next? My friend, you impose a painful task on me. Must you know all?"
"Absolutely, and rather from your lips than another's."
"Prepare your courage, then, for never will you have required it more."
Albert passed his hand over his forehead, as if to try his strength, as a man who is preparing to defend his life proves his shield and bends his sword. He thought himself strong enough, for he took fever for energy.
"Proceed," said he.
"The evening arrived. All Paris was in expectation. I used all my influence with one of the committee, a young peer of my acquaintance, to get introduced into a sort of gallery. He called for me at 7 o'clock, and before anyone had arrived asked one of the doorkeepers to place me in a box. I was concealed by a column and might witness the whole of the terrible scene which was about to take place. At 8 o'clock all were in their places, and Monsieur de Morcerf entered at the last stroke. He held some papers in his hand. His countenance was calm and his step firm, his dress particularly nice, and according to the ancient military costume, buttoned completely up to the chin. His presence produced a good effect. His committee was composed of liberal men, several of whom came forward to shake hands with him."
Albert felt his heart bursting at these particulars, but gratitude mingled with his sorrow. He would gladly have embraced those who had given his father this proof of esteem at a moment when his honour was so powerfully attacked.
At this moment one of the doorkeepers brought in a letter for the President. "You are at liberty to speak, Monsieur de Morcerf," said the President, as he unsealed the letter. "And the Count began his defence, I assure you, Albert, in a most eloquent and skilful manner. He produced documents proving that the Vizier of Yanina had, to the last moment, honoured him with his entire confidence, since he had entrusted him with a negotiation of life and death with the Emperor. He produced the ring, his mark of authority, with which Ali Pasha generally sealed his letters, and which the latter had given him that he might, on his return at any hour of the day or night, or even in his harem, gain access to him. Unfortunately, the negotiation failed, and when he returned to defend his benefactor, he was dead. But," said the Count, "so great was Ali Pasha's confidence that on his deathbed he resigned his favourite mistress and her daughter to my care."
Albert started on hearing these words. The history of Aide recurred to him, and he remembered what she had said of that message and the ring, and of the manner in which she had been sold and made a slave.
"And what effect did this discourse produce?" anxiously inquired Albert.
"I acknowledge it affected me, and indeed all the committee also," said Beauchamp.
Meanwhile, the President carelessly opened the letter which had been brought to him, but the first lines aroused his attention. He read them again and again, and fixing his eyes on Monsieur de Morcerf,
"Monsieur le Comte," said he, "you have said the Vizier of Yanina had confided his wife and daughter to your care."
"Yes, sir," replied Morcerf. "But in that, like all the rest, misfortune pursued me. On my return, Vasiliki and her daughter Aidée had disappeared."
"Did you know them?"
"My intimacy with the Pacha and his unlimited confidence had gained me an introduction to them, and I had seen them above 20 times.
"Have you any idea what became of them?"
"Yes, sir, I heard they had fallen victims to their sorrow and perhaps to their poverty. I was not rich. My life was in constant danger. I could not seek them, to my great regret."
The President frowned imperceptibly.
"Gentlemen," said he, "you have heard Monsieur le Comte de Morcerf's defence. Can you, Monsieur le Comte, produce any witnesses to the truth of what you have asserted?"
"Alas, no, sir," replied the Count. "All those who surrounded the Vizier, or who knew me at his court, are either dead or scattered. Alone, I believe, of all my countrymen, I survived that dreadful war. I have only the letters of Ali Tebelin, which I have placed before you, the ring, a token of his goodwill, which is here, and lastly, the most convincing proof I can offer after an anonymous attack, namely, the absence of all witness against my veracity and the purity of my military life."
A murmur of approbation ran through the assembly, and at this moment, Albert, had nothing more transpired, your father's cause had been gained. It only remained to put it to the vote when the President resumed. "Gentlemen, and you, Monsieur le Comte, you will not be displeased, I presume, to listen to one who calls himself a very important witness, and who has just presented himself. He has doubtless come to prove the perfect innocence of our colleague. Here is a letter I have just received on the subject. Shall it be read, or shall it be passed over, and shall we not regard this incident?" Monsieur de Morcerf turned pale and clenched his hands on the papers he held. The committee decided to hear the letter. The Count was thoughtful and silent. The President read, "Mr. President, I can furnish the committee of inquiry into the conduct of the Lieutenant-General, the Count of Morcerf, in Epirus and in Macedonia, with important particulars." The President paused, and the Count turned pale. The President looked at his auditors. "Proceed," was heard on all sides. The President resumed,
"I was on the spot at the death of Ali Pacha. I was present during his last moments. I know what has become of Vasiliki and Aidée. I am at the command of the committee, and even claim the honour of being heard. I shall be in the lobby when this note is delivered to you."
"And who is this witness, or rather this enemy?" asked the Count, in a tone in which there was a visible alteration.
"We shall know, sir," replied the President. "Is the committee willing to hear this witness?"
"Yes, yes," said they all at once. The doorkeeper was called. "Is there anyone in the lobby?" said the President.
"Yes, sir."
"Who is it?"
"A female accompanied by a servant."
Everyone looked at his neighbour.
"Introduce the female," said the President.
5 minutes after the doorkeeper again appeared, all eyes were fixed on the door.
"And I," said Beauchamp,
"shared the general expectation and anxiety. Behind the doorkeeper walked a female enveloped in a large veil which completely concealed her. It was evident from her figure and the perfumes she had about her that this was a young and elegant woman, but that was all. The President requested her to throw aside her veil, and it was then seen she was dressed in the Grecian costume and was remarkably beautiful."
"Ah," said Albert, "it was she."
"Who?"
"Aidée."
"Who told you that?"
"Alas, I guess it. But go on, Beauchamp. You see, I am calm and strong, and yet we must be drawing near the disclosure."
"Monsieur de Morcerf," continued Beauchamp, "looked at this female with surprise and terror. Her lips were about to pass his sentence of life and death. To all the committee, the adventure was so extraordinary and curious that the interest they had felt for the Count's safety became now quite a secondary matter. The President himself advanced to place a seat for the young lady, but she declined availing herself of it. As for the Count, he had fallen on his chair. It was evident his legs refused to support him. "Madame," said the President, "you have engaged to furnish the committee with some important particulars respecting the affair at Yanina, and you have stated that you were an eyewitness of the events."
"I was indeed," said the stranger, with a tone of sweet melancholy and with a sonorous voice peculiar to the East.
"But allow me to say you must have been very young then."
"I was 4 years old, but as those events deeply concerned me, not a single particular has escaped my memory."
"In what manner could those events concern you, and who are you that they should have made so deep an impression on you?"
"On them depended my father's life," replied she. "I am Aidée, the daughter of Ali Tebelin, Pasha of Yanina, and of Vasiliki, his beloved wife."
the blush of mingled pride and modesty which suddenly suffused the cheeks of the young female, the brilliancy of her eye and her highly important communication produced an inexpressible effect on the assembly. As for the Count, he could not have been more overwhelmed if a thunderbolt had fallen at his feet and opened before him an immense gulf. "Madame," replied the President, bowing with profound respect, "allow me to ask one question. It shall be the last. Can you prove the authenticity of what you have now stated?" "I can, sir," said Adet, drawing from under her veil a satin satchel highly perfumed. "For here is the register of my birth, signed by my father and his principal officers, and that of my baptism, my father having consented to my being brought up in my mother's faith. This latter has been sealed by the Grand Primate of Macedonia and Epirus. And lastly, and perhaps the most important, the record of the sale of my person and that of my mother to the Armenian merchant El Kobir by the French officer who, in his infamous bargain with the pot, had received his part of the booty, the wife and daughter of his benefactor, whom he sold for the sum of 400,000 francs. A greenish paleness spread over the Count's cheeks, and his eyes became bloodshot at these terrible imputations, which were listened to by the assembly with an ill-foreboding silence. Adet, still calm, but whose calmness was more dreadful than the anger of another would have been, handed to the President the record of her sale, registered in Arabic. It had been supposed some of these papers might be registered in the Arabian, Romaic, or Turkish language, and the interpreter of the house was in attendance. One of the noble peers, who was familiar with the Arabian language, having studied it during the sublime Egyptian campaign, followed with his eye as the translator read aloud, "I, El Kobir, a slave merchant and furnisher of the harem of His Highness, acknowledge having received for transmission to the sublime emperor, from the French lord, Count of Monte Cristo, an emerald valued at 800,000 francs, as the ransom of a young Christian slave of 11 years of age named Adet, the acknowledged daughter of the late Lord Ali Tebelen, Pasha of Yanina, and of Vasiliki his favourite, she having been sold to me 7 years previously with her mother, who had died on arriving at Constantinople, by a French colonel in the service of the vizier Ali Tebelen, named Fernand Mondego. The above-mentioned purchase was made on His Highness's account, whose mandate I had, for the sum of 400,000 francs, given at Constantinople by authority of His Highness in the year 1247 of the Hegira. Signed, El Kobir. That this record should have all due authority, it shall bear the imperial seal which the vendor is bound to have affixed to it." Near the merchant's signature there was indeed the seal of the sublime emperor. A dreadful silence succeeded the reading of this paper. The Count could only look, and his gaze, fixed as if unconsciously on Adet, seemed one of fire and blood. "Madame," said the President, "may reference be made to the Count of Monte Cristo, who is now, I believe, in Paris?" "Sir," replied Adet, "the Count of Monte Cristo, my foster father, has been in Normandy the last 3 days." "Who, then, has counselled you to take this step, one for which the court is deeply indebted to you, and which is perfectly natural, considering your birth and your misfortunes?" "Sir," replied Adet, "I have been led to take this step from a feeling of respect and grief. Although a Christian, may God forgive me, I have always sought to revenge my illustrious father. Since I set my foot in France and knew the traitor lived in Paris, I have watched carefully. I live retired in the house of my noble protector, but I do it from choice. I love retirement and silence because I can live with my thoughts and recollections of past days. But Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo surrounds me with every paternal care, and I am ignorant of nothing which passes in the world. I learn all in the silence of my apartments. For instance, I see all the newspapers, every periodical, as well as every new melody. And by thus watching the course of the life of others, I learned what has transpired this morning in the House of Peers, and what was to take place this evening. Then I wrote." "Then," remarked the President, "the Count of Monte Cristo knows nothing of your present proceedings?" "He is quite unaware of them, and I have but one fear, which is that he should disapprove of what I have done. But it is a glorious day for me," continued the young girl, raising her ardent gaze to heaven, "that on which I find at last an opportunity of revenging my father." The Count had not uttered one word the whole of this time. His colleagues looked at him and doubtless pitied his blighted prospects, which sank under the perfumed breath of a woman. His misery was depicted by sinister lines on his countenance. "Monsieur de Morcerf," said the President, "do you recognize this lady as the daughter of Ali Tebelen, Pasha of Yanina?" "No," said Morcerf, attempting to rise. "It is a base plot contrived by my enemies." Adet, whose eyes had been fixed upon the door as if expecting someone, turned hastily, and seeing the Count standing, shrieked. "You do not know me?" said she. "Well, I fortunately recognize you. You are Fernand Mondego, the French officer who led the troops of my noble father. It is you who surrendered the castle of Janina. It is you who, sent by him to Constantinople to treat with the Emperor of the life or death of your benefactor, brought back a false mandate granting full pardon. It is you who, with that mandate, obtained the Pasha's ring, which gave you authority over Selim the firekeeper. It is you who stabbed Selim. It is you who sold us, my mother and me, to the merchant El Kobir. Assassin, 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 you have still on your brow your master's blood. Look, gentlemen, all." These words had been pronounced with such enthusiasm and evident truth that every eye was fixed on the Count's forehead, and he himself passed his hand across it, as if he felt Ali's blood still moist upon it. "You positively recognize Monsieur de Morcerf as the officer Fernand Mondego?" "Indeed I do," cried Aide. "Oh, my mother, it was you who told me you were free, you had a beloved father, you were destined to be almost a queen. Well, look at that man. It is he who raised your father's head on the point of a spear. It is he who sold us, it is he who forsook us. Look well at his right hand, on which he has a large wound. If you forgot his features, you would know him by that hand, into which fell one by one the golden pieces of the merchant El Kobir. I know him. Ah, let him say now if he does not recognize me." Each word fell like a dagger on Morcerf and deprived him of a portion of his energy. As she uttered the last, he hid hastily in his bosom his hand, which had indeed been mutilated by a wound, and fell back on his chair, overwhelmed by wretchedness and despair. This scene completely changed the opinion of the assembly regarding the accused Count. "Monsieur le Comte de Morcerf," said the President, "do not allow yourself to be depressed. Answer, the justice of the court is supreme and impartial as that of God. It will not suffer you to be trampled on by your enemies without giving you an opportunity of defending yourself. Shall further inquiries be made? Shall two members of the House be sent to Janina? Speak." Morcerf did not reply. Then all the members looked at each other with terror. They knew the Count's energetic and violent temper. It must be, indeed, a dreadful blow which would deprive him of courage to defend himself. They expected this silence, resembling a sleep, would be followed by an awakening like a thunderbolt. "Well," asked the President, "what is your decision?" "I have no reply to make," said the Count, in a low tone. "Has the daughter of Ali Tebelin spoken the truth?" said the President. "Is she then the terrible witness to whose charge you dare not plead, not guilty? Have you really committed the crimes of which you are accused?" The Count looked round with an expression which might have softened tigers, but which could not disarm his judges. Then he raised his eyes towards the ceiling, but withdrew them immediately, as if he feared the roof would open and reveal to his distressed view that second tribunal called Heaven, and that other judge named God. Then, with a hasty movement, he tore open his coat, which seemed to stifle him, and flew from the room like a madman. His footstep was heard one moment in the corridor, then the rattling of his carriage wheels as he was driven rapidly away. "Gentlemen," said the President, when silence was restored, "is Monsieur le Comte de Morcerf convicted of felony, treason, and outrage?" "Yes," replied all the members of the Committee of Inquiry with a unanimous voice. Aide had remained until the close of the meeting. She heard the Count's sentence pronounced without betraying an expression of joy or pity. Then, drawing her veil over her face, she bowed majestically to the councillors and left with that dignified step which Virgil attributes to his goddesses.